This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your take it light, wait a while, of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
I was walking through icy streams that took my breath away. Moving slowly through westward water, over glacial plains, and I walked a few. Walked off and owned me. Owned me, oh my, I thought it was a dream. So it seemed.
If you know anything about Drip Drops, you know that that's Alaska, and that is Maggie Rogers. Maggie just put out her first album. It's called Heard It in a Past Life. It's currently number 2 on the Billboard album chart. Maggie Rogers, wild popular. Let's have a conversation about Maggie Rogers, and let's have an emotional conversation. And you know if we're having an emotional conversation on podcast, you know who's here. Lindsay Zoles is here.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm already crying.
I should hope so. Lindsay writes about culture for The Ringer, and Lindsay interviewed Maggie not that long ago. So we're going to talk about Maggie today, and we're also going to talk a little bit later about Sharon Van Etten. And at the end, I'm going to talk about James Ingram for a little bit, a very important person to me musically as a child. But let's start with Maggie, and let's start with that song. That song has some biography to it, some baggage, perhaps. Tell us about Alaska.
Alaska.
Yes. So,
well, the song and the video, when she spoke with me, she just referred to it as the video.
Yes.
Which we're not talking about the music video.
No, we're not.
So Maggie Rogers was a student. I think she graduated a year and a half ago or something from the NYU Clive Davis Institute, which is a branch of NYU. I don't know what school.
Yeah, it's sort of like for people who want careers in the music business.
Yeah, and it's a business and recording program.
Like some musicians, some people who like want to work at labels, maybe some people who want to be, I feel like maybe I've talked about journalism to some kids there at some point. Hey, invite me to talk to your class. Invite Lindsay to talk to your class. Anything.
We'll all cry together.
Yeah. And also anything that these young people think the music business is really like, we will absolutely tell them is nonsense.
Yeah. Cause we know it all.
So like if you're listening and you teach at Clive Davis, like please call us. Anyway,
so Maggie Rogers, and she had started out as this folk singer, essentially, which she played banjo and self-recorded at least one album that she put on Bandcamp, and I believe that album was her sort of submission
audition,
to get herself into this program that was pretty selective. So,
shouts to banjo players.
Shouts to banjos.
Everybody going to Galax this summer, let me know. You know, you want to catch me at Merle Fest? Well, Hank.
Yeah. Anyway, so she gets into Clive Davis. She is exploring different kinds of music genres and ends up writing the song Alaska for a master class that she did, I believe, her last year in school. And the instructor for their final project, which was a song that they were presenting, brought in a guest visiting instructor.
Speaking of someone who knows Drip Drops.
Pharrell Williams.
Oh!
There you go.
Yeah.
Just so, yeah. So she shows up to class one day and Pharrell is there.
Right.
And you're like going to present your final project and Pharrell is sitting there. So tension's high.
On video.
Yeah. They're even in the video, you can hear like cameras flashing. So it was very much I don't want to say staged, but it was people were going to be potentially viewing this experience. And she plays Alaska.
Yes.
Pharrell is moved.
I'm trying to do my best Pharrell listening to Alaska face, which I know is useless in a podcast, but like, let me
try to
tell me if it's good.
Okay. There's a lot of eyelid fluttering going on. I think just, and now your eyes have disappeared completely and rolled back into your skull. I don't know what that was.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, but
in that space.
Yeah, Pharrell really reacted,
you
could say.
It was the first time I've ever seen his skin wrinkle.
Yeah, I think he had never aged until that moment.
It's absolutely
and Maggie
true.
Rogers put like a year on him.
It's totally
the
true.
Emotional experience of listening
totally
to Alaska.
True.
But
get your Retin-A. Yeah.
So he really was impressed, had this sort of monologue afterwards comparing her to the Wu-Tang Clan, I think, which was really...
I have some side thoughts about has Pharrell ever listened to music before?
Like, I don't think sometimes, this like, was the first time.
Yeah. So, okay, I don't...
So that was part of why he was moved on camera. Yeah. Like, what are these sounds?
No. Can I just... maybe now's the time to jump in and just... okay, so this video took on kind of a life of its own. It was a good kind of like... posi energy viral moment of 2016 or 15.
A true Star is Born of our times.
Yes. Some thoughts about Pharrell.
Yeah,
let's go there. I have a lot of affection for. I've interviewed a bunch over the years. I know Pharrell to be a serious thinker and feeler about music. Mm-hmm. I was completely baffled by this thing. Mm-hmm. And the first time I watched it, I gave myself over to it, and I was like, damn, what? Okay, I went in. It's fine. By the third or fourth time, I was kind of like, he's literally never heard a record before. Like, he's never heard a record made by a young white woman, maybe? Like, I don't know. It's just Alaska's a good record. Uh-huh. Actually, maybe can we listen to the transition at the end of Alaska to when Pharrell starts emoting. Because I feel like maybe you want to catch a little bit of this energy before I tear it to shreds.
Okay. Wow. Wow. I have zero, zero, zero notes for that. And I'll tell you why. It's because you're doing your own thing. It's singular. It's like when the Wu-Tang Clan came out, like, no one could really judge it. You either liked it or you didn't, but you couldn't compare it to anything else. And that is such a special quality, and all of us possess that ability, but you have to be willing to seek, and you have to be willing to be, like, real frank in your music and frank in your choices. And sometimes, like, most of the time people will say, okay, I'm going to make this kind of song. So it ends up sounding like something we've heard before or felt before, you know? And I feel like what your whole story, I can hear it in the music.
So Alaska's good.
Good song.
I would not say it is the most original thing in the world.
No, and I think... part of what he said, which was maybe he had to be a little hyperbolic to get this to be the viral clip that it became.
Cameras are on.
But I think he said something like, I've never heard anyone who sounds like you.
Yes.
Which
that's my drug.
Yeah. He did. And again, compared it.
That and Botox.
To Wu-Tang.
Yeah,
which,
No
comment.
Allegedly.
There's
yeah,
it be was some secret,
there, right? You know, it's as Frank said, we need the keys. As Frank said, GQ, like, we need more keys. So Pharrell, if you're listening, number one, have you heard songs of this nature before? If so, it's cool. You can tell us. Number two, skincare tips.
Yeah, top shelf Pharrell.
Yeah, whatever it is, I'm ready. Get me the Lamero. I need the plug. So I thought that was strange, and especially I have a couple of other thoughts. a thing we talk about on Popcast a lot is something that we call Spotify Core. In many ways, Alaska feels like art school Spotify Core. It feels like a little proto. It's cleverer than a lot of the stuff that ends up kind of taking over your Spotify playlist in 2017, 2018. But the concepts are obviously, the packaging is already in motion. So there's that. Also, and this is just a left field take, I feel like there was a little something in the water at NYU around that time. Did you ever hear a group called Marian Hill? It was like a guy and a girl.
Yes.
There's a little like Marian Hill action going on. No biting, no cap, but it makes me wonder kind of like what was in the air at NYU.
At Clive Davis.
Circa like 2015. Wait, can we listen to some of this Marian Hill stuff?
Your call.
I'm just going out on a limb. I know this is just my particular hill to die on. I accept that. So yeah, let's listen to a record called Wasted.
You think I'm magical. You talk a fancy talk. Something intangible. In the way I walk. You've got no common sense. Boy, I've heard them all. Throw in your compliments up against the wall. You get me a drink or two. I already bought them. You would make my dreams come true. I've already got them. Words are blurring when you speak. Boy, I thought I told you. Now you're tripping over me. I'm not here to hold you. You're wasted. You're wasted on me. You're wasted. You're wasted. You're wasted on me. You're wasted. You're wasted on me.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made. Or how a wooden table is built, piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. I developed this recipe when I was down in Georgia with my family. It stars a Korean red pepper powder called gochugaru. I love the way it blooms in the maple syrup and the rice vinegar. If you don't have gochugaru, you should totally get some. It's super versatile. It's not just that it brings heat, but fruity sweetness as well. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
I would not agree with Pharrell that I have never heard anything that sounds right. Like that before. There's a lot of idioms. Like, it reminds me a lot of the Vampirity Ring.
Good catch.
Yeah. Of that. We're out, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that record came out like 2013 or something.
Do we have to go with Pharrell to Pitchfork Fest this year?
You can if you want.
Okay. You can FaceTime in or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Pharrell, you have an open invitation for us to go to Pitchfork Fest this year. So yeah, there was a little something. This was already happening. And again, it's not to knock the quality of what Maggie was doing, but that moment, and there's something she talks about in your story, it's something she talked about in the A&L story we ran on her that Alex Papademos wrote. That moment became so totalizing, so kind of like filling the room with kind of like noxious air. Like, how do you get around it? How do you like, especially when some of the underlying premise of it is false? Not that she said, but like,
yeah, that she's the next Wu-Tang Clan, which I. No matter what you think about her, she's not.
Is she selling merch that suggests that she is the next Wu-Tang Clan. Like, she should sell merch.
I'd wear that shirt.
I'd wear that shirt.
I don't know. Would I? I might.
Yeah, I'd wear it.
Okay.
I'd spend $25 on a, yeah, like, maybe with her face photoshopped in, like, between You, God, and Jizza or something.
And with the Pharrell quote, yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Like, Pharrell quote, like, up the sleeve, like a long sleeve, like, with the Pharrell quote down the sleeve.
Are we going to make these shirts?
Yo, merch. Anyway. Popcast merch coming soon. Coming soon. So anyway, this becomes this kind of, like, albatross. It doesn't seem like an albatross, but ultimately becomes one in her telling. When she spoke to you about that, how was she, reflective about it? Was she still carrying, were her shoulders down? Like, what was going on?
She, a word that kept cropping up in our conversation, she kept using the word agency, as, oh, yeah, though that were something that...
Well, she did just graduate college, so...
It's true. Yeah. And she also majored in English, so there were a couple sort of, like, things that we broke down and then was like...
Wait, did you major in English in college?
Did. It's all right.
That's all right. That's all right.
Okay.
I probably, if I had it together, I probably would have majored in English.
Well, I have a job, so that's a real positive. I mean, in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Major in English,
look at
kids.
Me now.
Major in English and listen to music. So agency.
Yeah. She, I think, was very aware of, you know, people actually, she said people still say to her, I love that song that Pharrell made for you, which... Clearly, they're not watching the video or they got other tabs open or something. Like, that is fundamentally not the point of he was responding to. She had produced this song herself and, yeah, written it and recorded it. And so I think she was very aware, you know, obviously of the gender imbalance of that, too, that people tend to ascribe agency to a whatever male producer,
right,
or someone adjacent to that. And as a woman who both... She wants to be a performer and a songwriter, but also seems really interested in the production side of,
yep,
things,
mm-hmm,
I think has been really trying to position herself and be deliberate with her words and her messaging about the fact that these are conscious artistic choices that she is making to, mm-hmm, work with bigger producers like Greg Kurstin. Or, you know, I think that was something that I just... felt like she had thought a lot about and maybe had a little frustration at just the way that those things were perceived, because she does, you know, she does it all, but she also wants to let these collaborators in and, like,
yeah,
you know, was going to this program that also was about music and business and how to market, yeah, yourself in this way. So,
and that's something she's discussed. I think it was in your piece where she talks about, like, why wouldn't she want to learn from, mm-hmm, these producers. And I think that was interesting, although, to be frank, I'm not convinced that what she achieved with those producers is any more effective than what she achieved on her own.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is worth noting. Like, I'm not sure there's anything better than Alaska on this record. There are a couple of the songs I like quite a bit. Let's listen to Falling Water.
My jam.
It's a good one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the producers that she ended up working with, it's Greg Kurstin.
Rostam.
Right, Rostam. And who's the third one?
Kid Harpoon, I think. I don't know who that is.
Shrug gif.
Shouts to Kid
Shrug
Harpoon.
Shrug.gif.
Yeah.
Can't wait till I have to interview him.
Yeah.
Sorry, man. So I guess what's interesting is the Maggie Rogers idea kind of predates the sonic explosion of music that is like roughly in this space.
Yeah. Can we talk about what the Maggie Rogers idea is too? Because
go
I
in.
Think so she did in this piece, like she suggested that I meet her. So we're at an Aura Photography
yes.
studio.
Right.
Which full disclosure I had been to before because I too was a woman in my 20s in New York.
Right.
And she had been there mm-hmm. as well. So we got our auras photographed.
And just as a sidebar, did your aura come up differently from being around Maggie Rogers, or was it consistent?
It was different from hers.
No, but I'm saying was yours longitudinally, year
oh,
to year.
Oh, like over.
Like, yeah, like was it different?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
It's always different.
Hmm. But was it because you were hanging out with Maggie Rogers, or because you yourself
her,
had grown?
Her glow.
Sorry.
It's okay.
We'll just keep it.
Keep it.
Keep it. Keep it.
It's part of our aura.
That's right.
Now.
That's right. That's your aura checking in on you right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. My aura was very yellow and hers was very green.
And what do those mean?
So I think that they are associated with the chakras.
Right.
So green is the heart chakra.
Okay.
And yellow is like the solar plexus chakra, which is like your ego. These
wow.
are things why I was probably the right person to take on this assignment was
yeah.
like I know that
yeah.
already. I did not.
Right, you
we
didn't
talked
need a
about
translation.
Tarot cards for like 5 minutes too.
Right. You didn't need a guide, but you didn't need a glossary.
No.
Right.
So I kind of can't knock the Maggie Rogers idea.
Okay.
Because I understand
that
I
idea.
Fall into some of those stereotypes as well.
So how did she describe the Maggie Rogers concept to you?
I don't know that she described it so mm-hmm. much as like I found her to really embody
okay.
it. She was
she lived. How did she live it? To you.
Well, she was wearing glitter on her face,
yeah.
first of all,
mm-hmm.
even though it was a rainy afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, there's something kind of new agey spiritual about her, but also in like a cool kid NYU
yeah.
way.
Right.
As sort of like, I know for certain that you can buy this record on vinyl at Urban Outfitters right now. Like,
oh, I
that
hope so.
Kind of
yeah.
vibe. And I think she's sort of unabashedly embracing that, and that's really who she is. And she is this, you know, NYU kid who
she was, like,
grew up on a
farm.
Yeah, and like one of the songs I mentioned in the piece, like one of the songs on her sort of banjo solo album that she did when she was a teenager was like thanking all of the trees in her forest and the chickens that laid the eggs and stuff. So she has made
Earthen music.
Yeah.
And of course part of her like awakening narrative is she like she went to Berlin. I mean, I guess you could have gone to Brazil, too. But she went to Berlin, like, went to some techno clubs.
Yeah, and, like, traveled all over Europe.
Right.
I assume for, like, a semester abroad.
Sure.
And Hunter Harris at Vulture has had some really crucial Maggie Rogers tweets. That
Hunter Harris?
Shout out, Hunter.
Top-level tweeter.
Like, who should get a Pulitzer for her tweets, let
absolutely
me just say.
Star proof.
But she was saying, like, Maggie Rogers makes me want to, like, move to Italy and befriend my neighbors and just, like, the plot of Under the Tuscan Sun,
yeah.
basically. And so there's a kind of, like, eat, pray, love, finding myself, mm-hmm. you know.
Visions.
Young woman.
A vision quest, kind of.
Yeah, thing. So if, you know,
right.
how, I, that's and, the Maggie and, Rogers idea. Basically.
Right. And so this earth, like, so. I my sense, if I'm being generous with regards to the Pharrell thing, my sense is what he was probably reacting to was the combination mm-hmm. of the kind of like earthen canvas corduroy person
mm-hmm.
next to him and the vocal approach with something that was like very clearly indebted to electro and house and like that kind of hard juxtaposition, my sense is probably what he was responding to.
Yeah, and I think fitting something of a personality and a kind of singer-songwriter quality into the pop idiom and into the kind of like modern millennial pop idiom
exactly.
too.
Right. When she did Saturday Night Live, she came out flowy dress, barefoot. This is, of course, the week before Greta Van Fleet. So it seemed 2 weeks before, like, so it seemed totally fine at the time. Like, you know, like, we had nothing to compare it to. You want to talk about the Hilton Halls moment?
Oh, yeah. Let's go there.
Yeah. So Hilton, I guess the day after she was on SNL, like, went on Instagram and just
I
came
think
to the
it
blowtorch,
was like,
or?
Like, several weeks after the
oh,
performance,
okay.
maybe, too.
Okay.
It was, like, even more left field in a since-deleted Instagram post.
Oh, he deleted it.
Yeah. So maybe.
Man, stick to your guns, Hilton.
But he dragged Maggie Rogers and made this
wait,
point.
We got to read it. We got to read it. It's good.
See, if you delete, you think you delete a gram, a tweet, we're going to read it on podcast here.
That's right. Podcast is where all deleted, yeah, all deleted tweets come. Okay. Thank you to Twitter user George Severus, who has the screen grab. Did I just read the whole thing? Yeah. It's good. It's good.
It's there are things to chew on there.
Yeah, it's all can... like it's all wrong. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not co-signing it.
No.
It's a good example of a person saying a thing about a thing that they shouldn't be saying. Got so it. Here we go. Hilton Ells. Can someone explain this young woman to me? I saw her on SNL and was struck not only by how unmusical she sounded, but by her beauty, which was the point. As far as we've come, we're still stuck in a place where youth and attractiveness are the commodity and actual talent the least of the packagers concerned. The packagers. That's actually my next job. I'm going to be a package. I just want to, I should put that out then.
If well, there's more than one, so can I join
yeah,
you?
Yeah. If anyone is looking to hire a packager.
Or two.
Yeah.
Packagers.
Yeah. We're good. Here. Just filing that away. Please. Keep that in the back of your mind. I felt badly that this young woman has lent herself. It's misspelled. Maybe he deleted it because there was a spelling error. Has lent herself to all this. But what can you do when fame is the dominant impulse? Kanye shrugged. There is a heart beating somewhere, and that's where the pathos exists in this and other situations where capitalism craps on possibility.
Woo!
Oh. All right, everybody take a 5-minute recess.
Yeah, let's take a break.
It's just, good Lord. Hilton, man, he went to Home Depot for that flamethrower, I'll tell you that. So, okay, so this is all wrong, but very enjoyable.
And I think would just like, I think it's up to everybody to have their interpretation of Maggie Rogers, but I think every word of that would just
be on the wrong on the yeah, side of not an accurate
exactly
interpretation.
The opposite of what she's trying to do. And I think, you know, that I think some of what he's saying, there are just better targets for that. It just
I'm gonna feels... yes, it's almost as if he watched the Ashley Simpson SNL performance and wrote. Maybe he just cut and pasted. Maybe cut and pasted from then. And this is from a very pro Ashley person.
Oh yeah.
But that's kind of the fervor of this reminds me of that. Also, great meme, photo of someone crapping on someone, capitalism written on the top person, possibility written on the bottom person.
Yeah, that's more merch. Or that's another
Maggie.
Shirt.
Yeah. Maggie, if you're listening, it's a great meme merch. Get involved. So, okay. So, but I think the Hilton thing reminds me that the music that she is making is kind of close enough to conventional centrist pop that it can sort of even like Hornswoggle, a person who's as astute as Hilton Hall's.
Yeah.
Not that I think he's paying attention to the Spotify new music playlist, but I think he, broadly speaking, is like a pretty decent sense of, has a good aesthetic sense, and even he's confused. Maybe let's listen to one of the songs that maybe is super confusing, even to me.
Okay.
Let's listen to Light On.
Would you believe me now if I told you I got caught up in a wave? Almost gave it away. Would you hear me out if I told you I was terrified for days? Thought I was gonna break. Oh, I couldn't stop it. Tried to slow it all down. Crying in the bathroom. Had to figure it out with everyone around me saying, you must be so happy now. Oh, if you keep reaching.
So this is like, in listening to the record, this is like the big pop, capital B, capital P song. That's how it feels to me. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Yeah, I do. It's not one of my favorites, yeah. Although I do really, it's, I think she said that that's the most recent song that kind of came after, you know, within the last couple months of her life. And it mm-hmm. seems to be a commentary on fame a little bit. And there's that line where she says, like, everyone around me is saying you should be so happy now.
Right.
And I do like that part. I do think that song can sound a little too polished, but I like that yeah. there's sort of a grit to her vocal when she sings. That line seems mm-hmm. to mean something to her.
There are, and throughout this album, there are a lot of lines. I wouldn't say that they're whole lyrics, like whole songs, but there are a lot of moments lyrically where you really feel the kind of like granular, either like young woman in the city or young woman who is being put upon because of sudden fame. There are like a lot of good lyrical moments sprinkled throughout here. And that, to me, the most reassuring part of this record, which I like but maybe don't love, are these lyrical moments. And I'm not saying like go back to the banjo, you know what I mean, by
yeah.
any stretch. But her comfort with writing quickly cutting self-aware lyrics, mm. like good couplets real quick, that is the most exciting thing that's happening on this album to me.
And I think she would think of that as an achievement, too. Again, sure. she started out as a songwriter and I think brings that perspective. Like, it seems like her project right now is just exploring all the different ways that she can get those songwriting compositions to sound and to work with, you know, to try to get them to sound like pop song. And I don't know, is that what she's going to sound like 3 records from now? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But she does strike me as someone who's thinking about the long game too and is sort of plotting a career, because I think the viral moment, you know, is sort of, it's the one hit wonder mm-hmm. of our digital
yeah,
era.
Like sure.
it's, and even, it wasn't even necessarily a hit for her. It was the video of someone reacting to her song
right.
became her one hit wonder moment. So I think that she seems, in reaction to that, she took a long time making this record,
yeah.
relatively speaking. She put an EP out mm-hmm. last year, right, you know, sort of on the momentum of the Pharrell video.
Right.
And then I think it seems took more time than maybe her label or someone higher up, the packagers, if
the
you
packagers.
Will, would have wanted. But she was very adamant about taking her time. And I do just think this record shows a lot of promise. Like you said, I think
yeah.
she has an interesting perspective as a songwriter and a craftsperson. Kind of reminds me of the Haim record, the last Haim record too, which
yeah.
mm-hmm. I think, you know, and I'm curious about and why the Hilton Alls post, and I mentioned Laura Snape's Pitchfork review
yeah.
in my piece,
mm-hmm.
that I am really interested in the way in which she is kind of polarizing to people who
yeah,
are
she's
looking
becoming
for,
unusual. It's almost, well, the Hilton thing is weird because he's just like,
yeah,
he's just like dive bombing in from like out of nowhere. But like, if the Pharrell thing had not happened, would she be such like an axis that people turned on? You know, I don't know. Like, if this record came out on Domino, you know, like if the Pharrell thing had never happened, she signed to an indie label instead of a major label, and this a similar sounding record, but not with named producers, but basically a similar sound record came out on Domino or whatever. Like, would anyone, like, would it be a 7.7 instead of a 5.8, or would, you know, would people react to it differently?
I sort of think they would, mm-hmm. and I don't say that to knock anybody.
Yeah.
Like critical
no.
take on it, but it,
no.
it just
shouts
has
to Laura,
been,
friend of the podcast.
I do really like this record, but I think some of the responses to it just have been really interesting in terms of thinking about how pop music, particularly made by young women
mm-hmm.
who maybe do want to embrace more of a major label
yeah.
trajectory, how that lands in the world right now and what that means. She also
save it for like the Sigrid record or something.
Yeah, they're yeah. just, I think. That's, at the end of the day, like, I respect if you think this album is, like, uninteresting and bland. I think there are kind of some middle-of-the-road aspects to it. But she just seems like the wrong target for some of the things that she is being saddled with, in my opinion. And I found her to be, I think, more, you know, it kind of comes back to that idea of agency that she mm-hmm. was talking about. I think some of the criticism, particularly what Hilton mm-hmm. wrote about her, kind of shows the peril of that and shows how readily people jump to conclusions when it is like a young, attractive woman
mm-hmm.
Who also happens to have this talent in the studio and as a songwriter.
there is a common thread that I found. You mentioned Haim. I was thinking a lot about early Mumford and Sons, that Lumineers moment, dark times. Was that like 2013 or something, 2012? I don't know. I watched it from my memory. I've had the chip replaced. But because doing kind of like electronic textured folk music or folk minded electronic, like people were already kind of like fiddling around with this. And to be honest, like, we dismissed it then, like, you know, like that this was watched before Maggie Rogers ever got to college. If anything, as compared to those records, I actually vastly prefer her take on it.
Yeah.
It feels smaller, a little more handmade. You feel texture in her production and in her songwriting. Like, there's, it doesn't feel as clinical as that other stuff.
Yeah. And I think it feels more modern in that way too. Like, she really, some of the people that she mentioned admiration for when we were talking were Grimes and Kevin Parker from Tame Impala, as, you know, as an artist who's become a producer and kind of an architect of his sound. And she also mentioned that she's good friends with Claro, another person who had this sort of viral moment and then is trying to turn it into a sort of avant-garde pop career.
Yeah.
So I think there are, like, the Mumford connotations. I think she did open for them at a point.
Did she?
Yeah, which
I missed that show.
Could be wrong. Yeah, I missed that one too. Yeah. But I think what appeals to me about this record is, like, she, you know, she's not like trying to wear the suspenders and pretend like, you know, call up Jack White and say no modern instruments.
Again, catch me at Merlefest this summer.
Yeah.
One thing that we mentioned earlier and comes up in your piece and also leads us a little bit down to where we're the next topic of the episode today. She's in a music business program. Like, she, there is something, I wouldn't say insider, that doesn't feel quite right, but she is of a generation that understands that, like, if you want to have a career, like, some of what you have to do is learn about marketing and promotion and presentation and publicity and all these things. It's not just like chanteuse puts songs out and magic things happen. There's something intentional about it.
Yeah, several times when I was talking to her, she mentioned making music as her job. And I kind of interrogated her about that a little bit. And I was like, you know, did you always, were you kind of conceiving of this as a career? And what she did say, I assume about the Pharrell moment was, you know, she was like, it was like, if anyone was new at a job and just out of college, I was still learning the ropes of how this works, and I still am, but I feel more confident. So she's coming at it from that, if you're cynical, you could say, as like a kind of business-minded, you know, what was it, crapping on the art of possibility or something?
Capitalism craps on possibility.
So, like, you could see it that way, but also
we should all write like Hilton Halls. What a gift.
Yeah, it's really
that's
quite vivid. dot dot dot.
Yeah,
but yeah. But at the same time, I think she's also, you know, a young millennial musician songwriter who kind of sees the only way to have longevity as a career in this industry that many people see sort of crumbling around them is to maybe get into that production world, to really learn these skills and think of them as a job rather than this, you know, this calling from on high, this romanticized thing. I saw her as someone thinking very deliberately about that, even if it wasn't as romantic as just her and the banjo.
So, Lindsay, in your piece, one of your secondary interviews, talk about Sharon Van Etten, which is what we're going to talk about a little bit today. One of the things I was really struck by is some of the backstory of Maggie Rogers and Sharon Van Etten is, like, not that different. Sharon, I mean, is older. She's in her mid-30s. She also worked music business jobs. Like, she used to work at, I think, Bada Bing. And, you know, what's funny is, like, we're talking about Sharon Van Etten. We're talking about Sharon Van Etten, and look who just happened to walk in.
Hey, guys.
Hey, it's Joe Coscarelli, pop music reporter of the New York Times.
Hey, it's me.
What a nice surprise. We just were talking about Sharon Van Etten and how weird that you just happened to walk in.
I just appear.
Yeah.
It's like when, what's Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary.
Yeah.
It's me.
We said Sharon Van Etten three times. You checked.
That's a weird skill, but okay.
Yeah, it's going to be exhausting for the next couple of weeks at least.
True story. So what a nice surprise that Joe is here. Joe, we've been talking about Maggie Rogers, and we were just pivoting.
What's the matter, Pedro? You don't want me to be here.
We were just pivoting. We were just pivoting to Van Etten, and now I have two people who interviewed Shara Van Etten.
It's true.
A bounty of interviewers. We were just talking about how Maggie Rogers and Shara Van Etten kind of have some things in common. They're both sort of like not quite insiders, but like music biz adjacent. Maggie through school and Sharon by working at labels and things like that in the, I guess it was the late 2000s.
The most successful music publicist of all time.
Quite possibly, yeah. There is something of the quasi-professional about them.
Yeah, I think they, obviously Maggie's career is very young, but I think they take their careers and their ambitions seriously. They think about things like legacy and like arc. And I think Sharon is particularly interesting because she both has a really successful music career, you know, as far as independent singer-songwriters go, but she also sort of has her eyes and hands on a bunch of other things, which we can get to. She, you know, is studying to become a therapist. She has started acting. You know, she's getting into comedy. She's, you know, she... I think she knows.
Who among us isn't getting it? Right. To be fair.
I think she. Relate.
Yeah, true. True.
She knows that.
Logic novel coming soon. Are you up on that?
That's true.
Logic
has a novel
Logic coming. Is a novel coming.
You have to have me back.
Yeah,
that.
obviously. We're going to be doing a dramatic read. We're going to have a special episode of Popcast just doing a dramatic reading of the Logic novel.
Can we record the audiobook? Is that, has he done it yet?
No, seriously, get at us.
Sharon, you know, she takes her music career very seriously, and it's sort of grown in this really natural, slow way. Like, I think she actually has the opposite problem of, or she doesn't have the problem that Maggie Rogers had, which is that, like, when it exploded right away really fast off of one song, like, Sharon has had, like, a much more gradual taking steps up. Like, you get a song in a Shonda Rhimes show, and that's like one thing, and then, you know, you end up in this commercial, and that's another thing, and your tours get bigger and your opening slots get bigger. And I think, like, she's had a pretty gradual rise over what is now like a decade long career. Does that seem right to you, Lindsay?
Yeah, for sure.
So let's listen to a Shara Van Etten song from the new album, which came out on the same day, I think, as Maggie's album. Sharon's album is called Remind Me Tomorrow. Let's listen to 17. So 17 is, I think, Joe, maybe, were you on the video shoot for this?
I went scouting for the shoot. So
of all the haunts of her 2000s indie rock.
Which was youth. Intense also for an NYU student like myself.
and like Maggie Rogers.
Maggie Rogers, because those things, you know, overlap. I think, like, her years of, you know, young adulthood on the Lower East Side were like the end of my teen years on the Lower East Side. So, you know, we went to her apartment off the J train. We went to what used to be Cake Shop,
R.I.P.
We went to what is Steel Pianos. Somehow, Pianos still exists. Another Lower East Side venue.
Deep sigh.
You know, and a couple other places like that. Zebulon.
Which Real Ones see. Always knew Pianos was whack, though. Just FYI.
Which you can, and Pianos, you know, she said was like the first place she ever played a show, and that like took her a while before she realized she could be getting paid for them. She was like, oh, like I thought it was just nice that they were letting me play. Like I should probably ask for some money. So, you know, it was fun to do that sort of stroll down memory lane with her. And then the video came out and it stars Rachel Trachtenberg, another young musician as a younger version of Sharon. And she's sort of chasing, you know, the ghost of her past through the New York of the late aughts, I guess. So,
and it had that specificity. Again, there is something like hearing Maggie navigate being young and into music in the city and then listening to this song specifically, which is about looking back on that experience. To me, I felt the threat, to say nothing of the production of this record, which is like adjacent to some of the things that are happening on the Maggie record, on this song rather, not on the whole album.
Well, there is one more explicit connection between the two, other than their albums coming out on the same day, which is that Sharon Van Etten's partner and former drummer, Zeke Hutchins, is part of Maggie Rogers' management team.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So
we just,
we
just threaded the needle.
Yeah. So they're literally connected behind the scenes. Sharon, you know, a lot of this album, I think, as Lindsay knows and wrote about, is about sort of coming to terms with, for once, being in a happy relationship. She, you know, was known prior for some of the saddest breakup songs.
Deep mournfulness.
Of her era. And then, you know, she talks about having fallen in love with her drummer on tour with Nick Cave, which, you know,
you're gonna fall in love somewhere.
Right. And you know, then he transitioned out from being her drummer to being her partner romantically and also her manager. And as he went into, you know, the music managing business, he also took on a young singer songwriter from NYU named Maggie Rogers. So it's sort of, I think, a nice full circle moment that,
sure,
you know, their albums came out at the same time with the support of this guy behind the scenes.
You were talking about some of Sharon's earlier work. For me, this is my least favorite Sharon record, and I think obviously those other ones are kind of like at their most powerful, like kind of like almost unimaginably sad.
Yeah,
like kind of like beyond normal adjective,
right?
Sad,
and with the content and like the sort of gravitas of her voice.
Yeah, exactly. And this, I don't know. I feel like it's been getting a lot of attention and energy, partially because I think it comports a little bit more with like dominant threads of pop music that's happening right now, and also it's like such an obvious aesthetic pivot. I don't know. Unpopular opinion. It doesn't do a lot for me. It's kind of grown on me over the last week or so, but to me it feels like the least successful, because it feels like the, I don't want to say confused, but it's kind of the least honed emotionally to my ear.
How would you describe how it sounds, Lindsay?
I like it a lot better than John. I think it might be my favorite album of hers, actually. Mm-hmm. And I have been following her for a long time. I think the first time I saw her live was 2010, when she was touring on the record Epic, which is also another favorite of mine. I think that's the one, you know, when you were talking about comparing their arcs, I think Sharon, sort of like Maggie Rogers, started out with these all acoustic, you know, slightly, her first record was pretty much just her and a guitar. And very
and like
intimate.
A soft string guitar.
Yeah, like very quiet, very just deeply personal, like she was letting you in on these secrets. And she's been adding more collaborators, you know, as time has gone on, and sort of expanding her sound, maybe working towards a, I don't want to say poppier sound. It feels different, but more of a...
It's not pop. It's like using some of the same toolkit, but it's not that the end is pop.
Yeah,
it's
but full, I think though. A song like 17, you know, she... she performed it on Kimmel recently, and it was like, this is one of the first Sharon Van Etten songs that I can see being performed on like a late night show of that. Like, it's an anthem.
Doesn't that just say more about late night television than Sharon Van Etten?
That's a whole nother podcast.
There's another interesting wrinkle with that is that she had also started writing a little bit, like thinking about pop songs. So there's a song on this album, Jupiter 4, which is named after the synthesizer that she used to sort of start a lot of these songs, which coincidentally belonged to Michael Cera, which I think is a funny detail. But there's a version of Jupiter 4 just called Jupiter that was released before this album, performed by a sort of a fellow New Jersey singer who is more of a pop singer, and her name I think is Donna Missile. You know about this?
Yeah.
Maybe we should listen to a little bit of both, like play Sharon's version of Jupiter 4 and then play Donna Missile's as well. So I think she definitely was moving in a direction, you know, where she felt more comfortable sort of, you know, there's a little bit of a swagger to this record, I think, in a way that you're not used to hearing from her. And, you know, the acts she's been citing as sort of inspiration, Nick Cave, one, you know, especially Skeleton Tree, his album from a few years back, which is very sort of drony and synth-based, and then Portishead, I think she was talking a lot about, like, Suicide, like, stuff like that, which is...
She even talked about Bauhaus.
Yes. Me.
So, like, really going to this dark place, almost defiantly so.
Yeah, and, like, you know, Trent Reznor, I think, was a touchstone, and these just aren't things you would think of when you think of, like we said, this sort of devastatingly sad, hushed acoustic guitar singer, but I think she's coming into herself, and I think because she was writing maybe like a happier album, but she didn't feel comfortable going all the way there. So like the music is just really like, it sounds a little bit like doom, even though the lyrics are more hopeful maybe than she's ever been. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I do think a lot of this record is pretty dark though. Like, I think it's her hopeful album on a relative scale of
I mean,
she had a song in the last record called Your Love Is Killing Me.
Right. I mean, you're starting at like negative 46.
Exactly. So I think that I like the edge of this record. And I also, we should say too that it's informed a bit by the experience of her becoming a mother and her son, I think is just turning two. And you can hear that in the way that she's reflecting on her past. She talked to me about how having a child has made her kind of see herself at that age and think about her past in the way she's thinking about her child's future, which was interesting. And I think you do hear something like that on a song like 17, where she's almost talking to this former version of herself as like a disembodied, separate entity. And also on that note, like she said, some of the ideas she had for this record were when she was like sleep deprived from breastfeeding and just being up all night with her child. So I think that's an element of this that I really like, of like the dark motherhood. She used the phrase with me, apocalyptic mom, which
yeah,
I like.
That's great.
That would also be a podcast merch.
Yeah, good merch.
Apocalyptic mom. And it's funny because I think building off of what you said, like that 17 video that we mentioned before ends at her parents' house, her actual parents' house and her driveway. And she was talking a bit about how her obviously becoming a mother had her thinking about what she put her own parents through and sort of the origin story of Sharon Van Etten. And as we learned it, as she was coming up was, you know, that she had basically gone to college in Tennessee, entered into what ultimately became an abusive relationship, and she sort of was, you know, the black sheep of her family. She went out on her own and then sort of had to come home with her tail between her legs and move back in with her parents and basically say, you know, I'm escaping a horrible situation. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think a lot of her early records are about, this sort of having had this horrible experience and then, you know, returning home and then sort of rebuilding her life.
Starting anew, yeah.
Yeah, and so I think if, like Lindsay was saying, like, if you've been invested in the sort of arc of her career and the stories she's telling sort of piecemeal throughout these albums, I think there's a lot of return on this to dig into this album if you're invested in previous iterations of her as a songwriter, I think.
So let's listen to one last song by Sharon. What do you guys want to hear?
Do Comeback Kid.
Let's get it. Thank you to Joe and Lindsay. I'm going to stick around for a few minutes and talk about James Ingram. But thanks, guys, for coming and dropping knowledge. Joe, always fortuitous and propitious when you show up.
Thanks for having me.
What
first podcast of 2019 for me. I missed you guys.
Before we go this week, I wanted to talk a little bit about James Ingram, who died this week. James was really one of the great R&B singers of the early to mid-80s. When Quiet Storm was a thing, James Ingram was a standard. I have very vivid memories of listening to James Ingram on the radio with my mom, some WBLS stuff in the early to mid-1980s, and hearing him in the car. Later in college, I used to do a radio show. It was a hip-hop show, but, you know, it was late at night, and sometimes I would do Quiet Storm Hour. Also, shouts out to Pete Armstrong, who was one of the alumni who also did Quiet Storm. And I used to play the hell out of James Ingram, man. I used to play a lot of James Ingram. I played, obviously, Jeffrey Osborne, Peebo Bryson, Atlantic Star, all that stuff. There's a real purity to James Ingram's voice. He sang with this, it's hard to explain because the singing was real precise and had real square corners, but it had this like lusciousness in the bottom of it. It was really impressive. Let's listen to 100 Ways.
Compliment what she does, send her roses just because. If it's violin she loves, let them play. Dedicate her favorite song and hold her closer.
The type of music that James Ingram made, kind of maybe for an older crowd, maybe for married couples, it was also not long for the world. Certainly by the mid to late 80s, you had New Edition and Bobby Brown. You had Guy. You had New Jack Swing sort of arriving in full flower and kind of taking R&B in a chokehold and wrestling it into submission. And the type of music that James Ingram made was not that popular anymore. He ended up having a few hits later in his career. He did the theme song with Linda Ronstadt for An American Tale. It's called Somewhere Out There. And then Peebo came and started taking all his soundtrack songs later on. Let's go out on Popcast this week with the last James Ingram, real James Ingram hit, which is one of my favorite R&B songs of all time. And which came, it came in 1990, really probably 2 or 3 years after it had any right to be popular. But in the midst of all this fascinating stuff happening at the intersection of hip-hop, R&B, this very classic, sharp, robust, felt, quasi-ballad, fast ballad, well, maybe not fast, maybe half-fast ballad, managed to get to number one on the Billboard Hot 100. To celebrate James Ingram's life, let's go out this week with I Don't Have the Heart.
Your face is beaming. You say it's 'cause you're dreaming of how good it's going.
That's our show. Thank you, Nora, this week's guests, Lindsay Zolads and Joe Coscarelli. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us anything that you're curious about Maggie Rogers or James Ingram or Sharon Van Etten at popcastnytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content, Stitcher, Apple, Spotify, etc., etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Head Snipper Media. We will be back next week.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that enables your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.